Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on December 5th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Please welcome Brian Rose.
And good evening, everybody. And please welcome Richard Price. Wearing his jacket.
Got it on eBay.
Photo op.
Looking good.
Quick, everybody.
I actually had this jacket. Phil Kaufman gave it to me, and I don't know what happened to it, so I bought this one on eBay.
Seriously?
And it's like three sizes too big, so I just finally have a reason to wear it for about 20 minutes.
Richard, I wonder if you could talk about the writing of this work. It was 1974. You were 24 when this came out, and later on you said this about writing it. If I had known what I was doing, truly known what I was doing, I might not have been able to do it. Sometimes things come easy. No book since has been that easy for me.
I just want to say something. Is this on? I don't think so.
There it is.
Hello? Okay. First of all, I did not write this screenplay. My book is, every novelist, when they see the movie adaptation, their hair falls out. I mean, look what they've done to my song, Ma. And so I had to adjust to the fact that Phil Kaufman had a little bit of a different vision than I did. And even tonight, I kept leaning over to my wife and saying, I didn't write that. And they said, are you okay, hon? Are you okay? I know we didn't eat yet. And other parts, I just felt like, wow, that was really good. And so, you know, honestly, I'm still of two minds. Movies give you faces. Movies give you colors, visuality. Novels give you depth. But it's quite the trade-off, because you can get some unforgettable stuff on a screen. That you can't find on a page. And then you'll find something on a page that no movie can give you. So it's a trade-off. And I really enjoy the parts I enjoy, and I just roll with it. I remember when the movie came out, they shot in my part of the Bronx. I knew every street, now they're going to tell me, oh, we really did it in Brooklyn. I hate Brooklyn. Otherwise, I'd have like a, you know, big, you know, blacksmith beard and a crew cut, and a Pendleton shirt, or is that like Chicano?
And some tattoos.
Yeah. Anyways, I remember when the movie came out. I went to see it in the movie theater right in the heart of my old neighborhood, where they filmed it, and it was like the Rocky Horror Show. People were lining up. They were talking back to the screen. Everybody in the movie theater was yelling out, don't fuck with the Wongs, before the Wongs said it. And it was a great, you know, it's the 70s, so I would take every date I had to, oh, come on, see my movie. It's premiering. You know, it's just a great, you know, blow your mind thing for a first date. Although a lot of them didn't really like it. And we went our separate ways. But I remember being online and to see the movie, and there was some girl in front of me, and she's Italian from the neighborhood, and I was saying, how many times did you see this movie? She said, six. She said, you know, they used my bedroom to shoot some scenes. I said, that's great. I said, I love this movie. I'm going to see this movie 10 more times. I said, you know, it was based on a book. She said, Yeah, I tried to read the book, but it sucked. But this is such a great movie. You know, so you win some, you lose some.
Well, as someone who's read the book, how many people here in the audience have read Richard's novel? We can say definitely it did not suck. It's a phenomenal book, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the writing of it. You grew up in a housing project in the Bronx. Was it somewhat autobiographical?
Yeah, I mean, the Wanderers are an actual gang.
This is off again?
Hello? Okay. The Wanderers was a real gang, right? Cat a corner from my building. and they were tough Italian kids for the most part. And I was in a Jewish gang. It was called the Warriors. But they became like legendary. The Ducky Boys were real. The Baldies were real. The Black Gang was real. That high school was like my junior high school. You know, and it was like an entire world. It's an entire cosmos with its heroes. And, you know, it's great beauties and legendary women. And its brains and its doomed people. It was just a whole world. But I didn't know what I was doing. I was my first year writing in a writing program at Columbia. I was 22. And I didn't want to write about, you know, write about what you know. I just didn't want to write about, you know, it really bums me out to be living with my parents in Co-op City now. So I started thinking back on the way it was. And it was only, gosh, it was only 7 years earlier, but I had gone to sleepaway school, and I was never going to really go back to the Bronx. So I tried to pull it all together. And the way I wrote about the stories, they were true, but, you know, it's kind of like true apocryphal. So my perspective was to write if my friends and the Wanderers were now 25 years out of the Bronx, and we had a reunion, and everybody got a little boozy, and they started saying, oh, remember the time? And every story would be a little skewed, a little exaggerated. So it was like my 100 years of housing projects, you know, the invention of ICE.
And each chapter was really a short story that you'd written kind of independently.
Yeah, that's the other thing. My original title was The Wanderer's Tales of Greaser Passion. And this is way before Grease, the play. You know, but Greaser was a word we used all the time for the Italian kids. And I sold it as, I thought it was going to be a collection of short stories, and the publisher said, nobody buys a collection of short stories by somebody they never heard of. We're going to call it a novel. I said, okie doke. I could care less. I was still in school. I didn't even think, I wasn't an author yet. I was a writer. And there's a huge difference. I mean, you're free. I was having fun. I was in my early 20s. I don't know. I was just writing. You know, I was writing in spiral notebooks and pen, ripping out the pages so they all had, like, fringes. And it was just, for me, I was just doing homework assignments, you know, for my fiction workshop. And, you know, it was great because I didn't know anything. And what I meant by, well, if I knew what I knew now, I never would. You know, sometimes you do things because you don't understand that you can't do them, so you do them. And The Wanderers was like that for me. And it was just, I was very naive, I was very dopey, and I was having a blast. You know, it was way before I got anxious about my career or anything like that. You know, every time I'd write a paragraph, I'd hey, come over here, you got to hear this. You know, paragraph by paragraph. It was a piece of cake, honestly. Never again.
The novel feels very cinematic. Were you influenced at all by movies and writing it?
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I was the first generation to grow up on TV as much as books. So that visuality just, it wasn't so much movies. But of course there was movies, but it's also TV. You know, everybody I know was like, we were TV junkies. Yeah, it worked its way in. I mean, there was a lot of like high speed, almost kind of like manic, cartoonish energy in the writing of the book, which the movie, crash, man, get some new, that, not, yeah, let me,
is that this on? Is wireless. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for voting for me. I'm going to make America, never mind. I mean, I was writing with like this bebop energy because I had just read Hubert Selby and a lot of the sort of the crossover from the Beats. You know, I didn't, but I also like social realism. So I really wanted to write a photographic portrait of that time and place and that mentality. But I also wanted to give it like lift. I didn't want to do anything earnest, you know, like Christ in Concrete or something. And so I had like a lighthearted zip in it, and I was really into the lyricism without the lyricism dominating the words. And that was hard to capture in a movie. That belonged to the book. So once again, I didn't write the screenplay.
Can you take us through the journey? How did the book get to become the film?
Oh, well, that's a... Okay, well, very quickly, I just... Oh, how did... Well, what happened is originally, when the book was published, my agent got a call from Samuel Goldwyn Jr., son of the Samuel Goldwyn. And he wanted to meet me, and he was staying at the... the Stanhope, I think. The restaurant that served mock turtle soup still. You know, it's right across the street from the Met. And I went over there. This is 1974. I was 24. And I heard he's a millionaire. It's like, it's like Gilligan's Island, the million. And I went over to his room, but I bought a special coat to wear to show him I'm no slouch either. And I went into this Arab-run men's shop on Broadway and 76 called Fuad, and I got an ankle-length coat that was giant box plaids in every color in the Crayola box. Listen, don't laugh. It cost me $24. So I went to the Stanhope. You know, they wouldn't even want to let me in. So I go up to his room, and there he is, you know, he's a big movie producer, you know, very kind of like waspy nice guy, even though he wasn't wasp. And his daughter was there, and his daughter's name was Cricket. And she was 22. And she was like the girl in the movie that was not Despy. I can't even remember characters' names. You know, she was from a different planet. And she was about to leave to go over to the Met and buy some paintings. Hey, who wrote this? Nina. And I just remember, as she was leaving, I thought I would really give him a compliment. And I said, wow, your daughter is fucking good looking, man. And here I am, still alive. And anyways, he bought an option on it. And the first thing they wanted me, for $1,500, they had it for a year. And he wanted me to write the script, which is a disaster. I'd never written a script before. You know, I worked on it 3 days, and they said, oh, never mind. And he dropped it. And then Phil Kaufman's son, Peter Kaufman, came along, read a book, like all teenage kids were reading that book. And he gave it to his dad. Dad, you got to read this. And Phil wanted to make it. But that was like 4 or 5 years later. And Phil and I, you know, kind of hit it off. And Phil wrote it with his wife, Rose. And it was really, I could tell you stories all night long about, you know, the bizarro stuff that happened. But it just, it was just cool. I mean, I'll tell you one story. Okay, the Baldies. First of all, the Baldies are like, wait, it's not even funny yet. Wait a minute. Now, the Baldies, they're all actors. So they got the biggest actors, shaved their heads, and put them in these leather jackets. But the problem with the chains and studs is whoever dressed them got everything at Christopher Street at the height of, you know, the dawn of, you know, gay on the street, be proud. And the real Baldies and the real gangs, and they look like shit. I mean, they had these beat-up belts. They had, if they had leather jackets, you know, they were ripped, they were covered with gasoline. These guys looked like they were about to go, you know, to the anvil. And that drove me crazy. So when they're shooting the recruiting scene where they go in drunk and they become Marines, you know, yeah, no physicals, by the way, even though the guy's 400 pounds. And it's a movie. Anyway, so the real actors there, and they're hanging out on the intersection of Grand Concourse and Fordham Road, right by Alexander's department store, Lowy's Paradise, this massive Moorish movie palace. The problem with the Bronx in 1978, they were real gangs, but these gangs weren't, you know, greaseball gangs. These were gangs from the South Bronx, and they were mainly black and Hispanic, and they were killers. And they all had names like the Chengalings, the Savage Skulls, the Savage Nomads, and all seemed to be about 5'4". And so they heard, you know, they're shooting this movie, so all these like Marabunta ants, you know, come over to the set. And they were all wearing, you know, denim jackets with cut sleeves, torn sleeves, you know, with flaming skulls on the back and forage caps. I mean, these were. This is the Bronx at one of its nadirs. There's been a few since. Anyways, so you have all these big guys in leather jackets, and all these Marabunta ants start circling them and kind of like sniffing them. So what are you doing, man? What's that jacket about? You know, and these actors started getting freaked out. It would take three Savage Skulls standing on top of each other's shoulder just to kiss this guy in chrome. And the actors, I remember one actor, he kind of left the set, he moved, went to a payphone, and he started shrieking at his agent in Hollywood, saying, "What did you get me into? You got to get me out of this." You know, and, I mean, nothing happened, but, you know, it's just, there's life, man. And you can't be. God is a first-rate screenwriter? I don't know.
Well, speaking of getting into the movies, how did you get into this film in your cameo in the bowling
I just said,
alley.
"Hey, Phil, put me in the movie," and he did. And the Galasso brothers—I got to tell you—I get strangled in this movie. If anybody recognized me in the bowling alley, there's a guy that strives 20 pins, 50 pins, and the guy behind me who was strangling me—he had a big cigar, and he was like a goon. And he said to me, "I got to warn you, I don't know my own strength." I said, "Can I have a turtleneck?" You know, and he strangled the crap out of me. And in the downtime, I'm asking, none of the Galassos are professional actors except for Dolph Sweet, you know, who played Despy's father. You know, he was a true actor. But these other guys, they were just, you know, big gavones from Marsh Park and, you know, Arthur Avenue. And I remember talking to the guy that was strangling me afterwards, and he said, "So, I said, what are you doing? You're not making movies." He says, "I'm a social worker." And he said, "Oh, really? Yeah, I'm a community activist social worker." "What does that mean?" "Well, in my neighborhood, you know, slashed tires, bricks through windows, no niggas. I'm a social worker." You know, I said, "Well, yeah, so you got your MSW, and but they're all like that. Well, you know, that guy Pepe Dio, the old guy behind the bar, they got him in a sort of like a welfare old age home. They just pulled him out, said his lines, and they popped him back in." Bob Dylan actually wanted to be in the movie because he was a friend of Phil Kaufman, and Phil said no because he knew if Dylan was doing that scene, he would just control the entire movie. And it just wasn't worth it, although it would have gotten a little more publicity, I think. But and all the horrible thing, too, is it came out the same week as another gang movie. I want to say The Warriors again. The Warriors. So you had two gang movies coming out on the same day with The Warriors. And I remember Phil got pissed off because Walter Hill, who made the Warriors, saw an early cut, and all of a sudden he put in a gang with a shaved head. You know, but
to conclude, why don't we talk a little bit about the fact this audience here, I bet many of them have seen this film a lot of times. What is your feeling about how this movie's become a cult classic over the years?
Well, I don't know anything about it. I mean, I knew, you know, when it came out, Phil would tell me that every year in Aspen or some film festival in Colorado, you know, people go out every year, they wear Wanderers jackets, and it's, you know, it's sort of a culty thing. But I was in cult therapy, and I don't know about cults. You know, I just, It was fun to take dates to see the movie. But, you know, like I said, it's a flinch factor for me. Then every once in a while, I just marvel at, you know, something that was very moving. Even the walls in the hallways, when Perry and Joey, who I thought should go off to Christopher Street and wear those outfits, by the way, this movie, you saw how gender fluid this movie was. It's way before its time. No, I'm sorry, this is the most retardedly male-centric movie. But, you know, we laugh at that. What was I saying?
You were talking about what it's like for you to look back on this film and think about how it's found an audience almost every year with new fans.
Yeah, but see, that's detached from me because I live in New York City. You know, I don't live in, you know, Aspen or wherever it is. I mean, it's, you know, if thing lasts long enough, it grows on you and you have an affection for it. And yesterday, Tony Gannios was here, Karen Allen, who played Nina, and Tony Kalem, who played Despy. They're all here and had a Sunday afternoon performance. And so I saw them again. And Tony Gannios is like enormous, except he's 50 years old, enormous, not like, you know, 20-year-old, enormous. And, you know, Karen Allen, you know, Tony Kalem wrote a script for Sopranos. She acted in Sopranos. And now she's directing a movie. Ken Wall, who played Mr. Handsome, you know, he did Wise Guy, that series with Kevin Spacey. Right now, I think he's married to a former playmate, Penthouse playmate, and they're both obsessed with saving animals. I guess that's good. And John Friedrich, you know, who played Joey, who I thought was the best wanderer, he's disappeared from the film world. He's teaching now in New Mexico. I don't know what he's teaching, but he has a family. And I remember the auditions. Where Phil said when he met Linda Manz, there was no character like Linda Manz in the book, the little tiny girl. And she just came in when he was casting at this hotel, the Regency, I think, in New York. And she came in. She was so tiny, she sort of jumped up on his chair, and her legs were swinging, and it was about a foot clearance between the bottom of her sneakers and the floor. And he says, yeah, I could do this. And Phil said, Rose, we got to write it apart. And that's how she got it. I remember Lawrence Fishburne, as a teenager, came into an audition, and he had just done Apocalypse Now. And he was kind of a wild teenager. And he came in there, yeah, I can do this, I can do this. You know, I work with Coppola and everything. I don't know if he was stoned or anything. Like, but he sat down, he was talking about himself, and all of a sudden he went, whoa, and the chair tilted over backwards. It broke the chair. It landed on his head. He didn't get a part. And the guy that played Clinton Stitch, Michael Warren, he's still kind of like in the acting world, but kind of out. I don't know what his life is like now. It might not be that great. But I remember the only time I ever went to Studio 54, I was got into Studio 54, when Michael Warren, who was a male model before this movie, he took me and my buddy at that time, John Califano, who's the other bank hustler who gets punched, and he said, we're going to go to Studio 54. He said, I am not worthy. He said, just walk behind me. And it was big mobs. And he stops, and he puts on this walk. I mean, I'd never saw anything like it. And he said, stick your finger in my back belt loop. You know, and I just walked in with him like we were a train. And it was in there, and I went, wow, wow. And that's all I remember.
Richard, we want to thank you so much for sharing your memories. And by the way, 2 weeks from tonight, Phil Kaufman will be here via Skype talking with Bruce Goldstein about the film. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for coming. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.